We're here to make a dent in the universe, or else why are we even doing this?
If I don't think I cut out with the fun stuff, because that to me is the fun stuff.
Build that audience, because if you've got no one to sell it to, then it's just going to flop and die, and no one likes a floppy, right?
I'm yet to meet a woman who just kind of grew up confidently in her body.
Welcome to my podcast. I'm Nicole Bremner. Join my weekly conversations with really interesting people as I delve into the stories and experiences that make them uniquely them.
Hello, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome back to my podcast. And this week's guest is a bit like Beyonce. He's just got one name, Martin. At least that's how he signed up, so it made me giggle. He's the founder and the driving force behind the Money Group's inaugural company, London Money. Now, in his third decade of working in the financial services, clients and partners benefit from his wealth of experience and intimate knowledge of the mortgage market. He believes that those running financial services businesses should always be the leader when it comes to doing the day job. And one of his current day jobs is being the director of the Money Group. Being the director of this flagship brand, London Money, which has been directly authorized since 2011. And we're going to go over what it means to be directly authorized and an authorized representative, etc. Martin quickly identified that this was the sector that was ripe for exponential growth and believes that unifying a previously fragmented sector was the best way to get a broker at the forefront of the industry where they rightfully belong. Again, another really interesting point we're going to discuss. So I welcome Martin.
What an introduction.
It did make me chuckle, though, when you signed up. Everything's just Martin.
Yeah, that's it. It's like Messi, Ronaldo, Beyonce, Madonna, Martin. It's all part of the same branding.
That's right. You're just Martin. And before I started researching ahead of this conversation, which we'd agreed to have quite a while ago, yeah, and it's just taken a while for various reasons, but I thought that what you did was spend a lot of time being very intelligent and witty on Twitter, and I didn't realize there was this whole other business behind you. But did it all start, I'm guessing, it all started with London Money. So who and what are London Money?
Yeah, it probably started 30 years ago, Nicole. I mean, as everyone in business will attest to, you know, you're never an overnight success. You know, arguably, you never arrive. It's a continual reinvention of the wheel as you go along. So, you know, I've been doing this job for since 1991, and it's changed massively along the way. I suppose to answer your question, I probably didn't take it seriously until 2011, which makes a mockery of the first 20 years, makes you wonder why I bothered doing it at all. But until I actually became an owner of my own business, until I actually got ownership of what I consider a brand to be, I don't think I really gave myself an opportunity. So, yes, it did start properly in 2011 with London Money, which is a directly authorised business, and we can probably debate what that means as we kind of go along. But what it meant was, from my point of view, that it was my name above the door. I was in control of that business from a marketing point of view, from an advice point of view. Everything kind of fell down at my doorstep, which is fine. That's probably what I was looking for. This was coming out of the credit crunch, which you're probably very familiar with. 2009, 2010, 2011 was not a great time to be in financial services, and a very, very poor time to be an intermediary of mortgages, because the industry effectively closed down for a number of years, not literally, but it certainly felt that way. So as with all good businesses, they tend to come out of a downturn, they tend to come out of a recession. So I kind of used that opportunity just to actually back myself for a change, rather than allowing other people to do it or piggybacking off somebody else's hard work.
And was that something that you really consciously did? You thought, right, we're in a recession. There's not much going on in the mortgage market. I'm going to spend that time creating this brand.
Yes. There's probably two answers to that, Nicole. One is, yes, that to me was the perfect time. If you're if you can see that your industry is not performing very well, you look at two things. You look at yourself and you look at the people around you that are supposed to be managing you or encouraging you or developing you. And what I found is that the people that I was working for and under back then actually didn't have an answer to what was going on. So it kind of made me realise that I was probably in the wrong place at that particular time. And it comes down to ownership of the problem, ownership of the situation. And the only way for me to kind of combat that was to own the business. Now, I was never going to own the business where I was working back in 2011. So it was a question of creating it, you know, from a blank piece of paper and on the kitchen room, the dining room table, which is where all great businesses are formed, and kind of go from there.
And what was the problem? What was going on in the industry at that moment that you sought to change?
Well, there's loads. If you think about the glory days of 2000, I mean, you've all watched The Big Short. I mean, 2007 was a fantastic year for anyone in business. You couldn't fail. But it was, the problems were already coming back then. I remember reading loads of things at the time and thinking, this is going to blow up at some point. And, you know, eventually it did. It started with Northern Rock and ended with Lehman's. And then the repercussions of that happened for a year or two afterwards. So the real issue was mainly probably liquidity and trust within the market. So the banks stayed open, but they had no real appetite to lend. So I haven't got a functioning business, and mortgage brokers wouldn't have a functioning business if they can't find a lender with the money to lend to our clients. And that's effectively where we found ourselves. On top of that, what you also had was a degree of distrust in the banking system. It was very prevalent back then. We came out of the vampire squid era, which was the accusation was thrown at all the investment banks that they were reckless and careless, and to a degree that, you know, it was a fair criticism. What we also saw is that some lenders used that opportunity, that downturn, to do a bit of a land grab and take back the market share that we'd created for them in the good times. So we were competing with some big banks with dual pricing, as in, you know, if you go to an intermediary, it's 2%. If you come to us, it's 1.5%, or we can't really compete with that. So there was lots and lots of headwinds at the time, lots of uncertainty around. And that's when I decided to start my own business. It just seemed like a good idea at the time.
And looking at your branding, the Money Group is one of the best recruitment style websites I've seen. And clearly you were onto something right at the beginning when you called London Money, London Money. Yeah. Did you realise how big it could be at that time?
It's a really interesting one, because sometimes, I mean, the simplest ideas are the best ideas, Nicole. You know, you can spend an awful lot of money rebranding and end up with something that's worse than what you started off with. And I remember just sitting at my kitchen table in 2011, I think it was, and just writing down the first five or six words that came into my head, two of which were London and money. And I was living in Ealing at the time, so it made perfect sense to me. Sometimes do what it says on the tin. You know, if you're living in London and you work in money, well, that's probably not a bad name for your business. So once I've written it down, I thought, well, somebody must have that business already. That's too obvious a name for it not to have been taken. I Googled it, and it was available. I mean, slight permutations here or there, but no one actively promoting a London Money brand. In terms of how big that idea can be, and this is probably where we are a little bit now with the brand, because, you know, I'm big on brand. That's really, really important. I get a lot of criticism for talking brand all the time. I talk brand more than I talk mortgages, but I think it's interesting because there aren't too many financial services brands in the UK outside of the big insurance companies, investment banks and retail banks. So I thought there's a space there that's you know, we can attack. The simplicity of the branding is very straightforward, as much that we can open up an office in Manchester and call it Manchester Money. We can open up an office in Liverpool and call that Liverpool Money. So that continuation of a theme I found very, very appealing. And what it also gave us was actually probably an unlimited market. Until we've run out of cities, towns and villages and adjectives, there's probably not a lot that we can't add the word money to without actually becoming a brand quite quickly. And just for a bit of context with that, it's very much similar with the Stelios EasyJet brand. You know, he puts the word easy in front of jet, money, property, whatever else he's got on the go at the moment. And it becomes brandable straight away. So our principles are the same, but adding money onto the end of a word or a place or a location or a service has the same effects. Now, I'm nowhere near Stelios' wealth, and I might never achieve that, but there's a synergy there. There's an idea there that we've kind of took and we've run with it.
Yeah, I love how it was premeditated in a way. It wasn't just, oh, we've got London money.
Yeah.
Let's move with this. And so you've got a number of the monies all set up already. You've got Teesside, Manchester, West Yorkshire. Help me out. What are the other ones?
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember them either. So you got to finish all this stuff. there's probably 15 to 17 different branded businesses that we've got. Maybe four or five in the pipeline due to come through. We're always trying to innovate the business as well. I mean, it's very stupid, and you would know this from being in business, that you can't operate and assume that everything's going to stay the same. Okay, and it's stupid not to be adaptable. And that's one thing we've probably learned over the past sort of 2-3 years, maybe expedited via the pandemic, that we have to constantly evolve it on. We can't be too precious either about what we're doing. If we want to partner with a successful business at the moment, but they maybe don't want to rebrand straight away, well, we'd be stupid to close the door on them, because the opportunity might not be today. It might be a year or two down the line. So from our point of view, I think we will continually pivot the brand and the branding wherever possible to maintain that forward momentum, because, you know, I've seen lots of people come and go in our sector, and that's a big risk, that getting sustainability and traction and scale in our side of financial services without a bottomless pit of money is very, very difficult.
Your background as an IFA, how did that mould your decision to start London Money and the other monies, or the money group? Because if I think about the financial planning, wealth management, IFA world, there are some very big players where they're sort of consolidating the smaller one-man band type thing. So is that where you got the idea from?
No, I think... I think that the idea of consolidation is something that I've grown into since we started. So, yes, I used to be an IFA, and as I've mentioned earlier on, I wasn't a very good one, and I hold my hand up to that, because I could see the direction that financial planning was going. It was moving away from the jack of all trades, I can do your mortgage, I can do your pension, I can do everything else in between. It's becoming too specialised. So when RDR came along in 2012, there was a minimum qualification that you had to meet to do that. I mean, I ordered the manuals. I took 2 minutes to look at it, and then I think it's probably still in the cupboard somewhere. So I knew that wasn't going to work for me. And actually, RDR was very, very good for the wealth management industry. If you look at the standards that they have now, people are chartered, people are certified, they work very much like accountants and solicitors. And that was always going to be the evolvement, I think, for that sector going forward. There is a huge amount of consolidation going on within the wealth planning industry. I think it needs to come to the mortgage intermediation industry in exactly the same way it has done there, because it is tremendously fragmented, tremendously fragmented. You might have... I mean, no one actually knows the real numbers. There might be 12,000 mortgage brokers in the UK. I think it might be slightly more, but 4,000 or 5,000 of them are Freds in the shed, you know, on their own, one-man bands. And commercially and regulatory, that's quite a difficult herd of sheep to manage. It's impossible to manage. The regulator, probably the FCA, probably authorised something like 60,000 firms of some description. So, you know, Keith in his shed in Chelmsford is never going to appear on the radar for the regulator. That could be a good thing or it could be a bad thing. But I think there is scope to consolidate the sector. And I think that will help the consumer. It will help the regulator, commercially more viable for the lenders, and probably better for the brokers as well.
Yeah, it seems like it's a very difficult thing for, say, the lenders to deal with when there are 12,000 different participants within that industry, all really trying to get the same deals. And even though, yes, they're paid on lending money, there's only so many clients that can go around all these people. So it does seem like it's overly fragmented.
I don't think we're going to run out of clients. This is where the industry's changed massively, Nicole. I mean, when I started in 1991, there were over 250,000 financial advisors of some description registered at that time. And that was at a time when nobody wanted to speak to us. You look at it now, you might have 20 to 30,000 registered advisors and 26 million adults that want to speak to us all the time for lots of different reasons, mainly the complexity of the marketplace. So we're never going to run out of clients. From a mortgage point of view, pre-pandemic, 75% of all lending came through intermediaries. So we were actually quite in a very, very good position before the pandemic. That's now assumed to be around about 90%. So if there are any winners from the pandemic, you know, mortgage brokers are definitely in with a shout of claiming that. I think it's easier for the lenders to promote their products through intermediaries from a risk point of view and maybe from a cost point of view. Where it's difficult for the lenders is if I run a business and we have 100 brokers, the lenders can come to me for influence. But if you've got 100 men or brokers or individuals working from home on their own, very difficult for the lender to speak to those people to find out, you know, trends, what's going on. What you'll also find is that sometimes it's the one-man bands that cause more problems for the lenders than the bigger organisations. They might lose a lender once a year and it doesn't go very well, and they spend hours clogging the phone up trying to get a problem fixed that they've probably created in the first place. So that's where the economies of scale can be quite good from a lender point of view.
Yeah, and you've also got the compliance structures in place, and you've got these systems in place that probably make it much easier for the lenders to work with than your example of Keith in the shed. It's astonishing, that growth in the number of people who are using an intermediary. Why do you think that has grown so much?
There's probably a couple of immediate reasons that I can think of. One is mortgage brokers are a bit like the crocodile, in as much that we've been around for 4 billion years and nothing seems to be able to kill us off. So we managed to get through the credit crunch and through the pandemic. But good brokers survive those downturns because they're sensible business people in the main, and they're quite resilient. So longevity in the game means that, you know, I started many moons ago, and now the clients that were first-time buyers for me 25 years ago are introducing me to their children, who are now first-time buyers, which shows you how old I am. But it's a good example about time in the game. So that means that those people will never actually end up going to a bank or a building society for mortgage advice, because I'm kind of part of the fabric as far as they're concerned. The other side of the fence is that lenders haven't really helped themselves in the way that they've closed branches left, right and centre. And something as complicated and complex as a mortgage, you know, people do like to sit down face to face to have a detailed conversation with someone about that. And that's difficult if you have to wait 2 weeks for an appointment with a bank for a 2-hour interview, which is very methodical and boring, by which time everyone's lost the will to live and they'll be asking their friend if anyone knows a good mortgage broker. So, you know, it's kind of played into our hands a little bit in that respect.
And you say that you want to put the mortgage broker at the forefront of the financial services industry. What do you mean by that?
Well, within our industry, there is an awful lot of white noise, okay? There's a lot of micromanagement, and there's a lot of affiliate businesses that have grown up and munching on the revenue that we kind of generate through doing our day job. That over time has begun to annoy me significantly, when actually the job itself is very, very simple. All I need to do is find someone that's got a need, and then I can spend, you know, my time educating them about what a solution might be, and then the resource of the business to process that on behalf of the client. I don't really need anyone other than the bank to help me do that, because they're the ones with the money. So I find it very frustrating over time that huge industries have built up around that, a very parasitic type of industry that go, well, actually, we can do that for you, or you have to use this particular service, or we're going to reinvent that wheel and then you'll have to pay for it. All that stuff came out of the industry over the past sort of 10 to 15 years because, you know, it's been a significant growth industry. And that's obviously going to attract people into it because they can see an opportunity for themselves within it. It all boils down to all those third-party affiliates. If they weren't here tomorrow, our industry would still be working. It would still be functional. If the client disappeared tomorrow, as they did in 2008, you struggle to have an industry. If the lender disappears, as they did in 2008, you struggle to have an industry. If the brokers all died inconveniently at the same time, then you wouldn't have much of an industry either because 90% comes through us. So the three most important people are the client, the lender, and the broker. Mm. And I think sometimes the broker's kind of been undermined a little bit over the years. And they've kind of become almost suffered a little bit from the Stockholm syndrome where they think that some of these people are their friends when actually that's not the case. So our job really, the Money Group, is to push these people forward and actually give them support so they can actually become not just successful mortgage brokers, but successful business people as well.
It's just turning that whole customers first around a bit. So your team's first, the people who work for you are first, and if they're happy, then they'll be able to make happy customers.
We're very, very, very strong in collaboration, Nicole. Very, very strong in collaboration. If it benefits the consumer, if it benefits the lending partners, if it benefits us as a business, you know, collaboration is key to all of that. Whereas previously, it's been quite aggressive in terms of, you know, client ownership, not sharing best practice, not sharing good ideas, quite isolationist in terms of its principles. That's how ownership is operated. So trying to break into that and say, actually, do you know what? By collaborating more and maybe giving up something, you'll actually get more in return. That's kind of our approach.
Can you talk us through being directly authorised versus an authorised representative? And then perhaps that will lead on to your new network, which I believe is called Mortgage Introducer. So could you just take us through the various ways that a broker can be authorised by the FCA?
Yeah, it is complex. I don't think we're going to finish this off.
Very simply, obviously, for me to understand.
I always try and give an analogy if I can. So let's use your podcast as an example. Okay, this is an independently run podcast. Okay, you've created it yourself. You find the guests yourself. You promote it yourself. Everything is down to you in effect. Yeah, that is the equivalent of a directly authorized mortgage broker. Same principles are applied. We're in charge of that. We make the decisions of whether the good ones or bad ones. It all comes down to us. We're directly responsible for the job that we do and the advice that we give. If you work for somebody else who had an umbrella organization that provided you the services to do the podcast, then that would be like an appointed representative. So you sit under their umbrella and you would pay them a percentage of the money that you generate from the work that you do as a podcast, but they take over the ownership and responsibility for whatever the content is. Does that work as an analogy?
It does, yeah.
It does in my head. I hope it does in yours. So, same with us. So you're either going to do it yourself off your own back and live and die by that principle, or you will sit your authorization under an umbrella organization. They will take a percentage of your revenue for looking after the PI insurance, the regulatory work, compliance and marketing services, all that kind of stuff. And that then becomes an appointed representative. And they're probably the two main strands of authorization. And again, there's never any really clear data, but I think it's something around 55% of the brokers are appointed representatives. And about 45% of them are directly authorised.
Okay.
And there's pros and cons for both, by the way, Nicole.
Yeah, it seems that there's the autonomy on the one hand and 100% of the revenue, but then you've got the side that could be the headache, such as the compliance, the regulatory side, the insurance, as you mentioned.
Absolutely nailed it. That's effectively what it is. And human beings will always opt for the lowest common denominator. And one of those two things will appeal more, either the autonomy and control versus the I don't want headaches, someone else can do it. And then once people decide which one they are, that will probably end up deciding what authorisation route they will go down.
I would go with the appointed representative all the time, because it's just, it's a headache dealing with those things from experience. I know dealing with the FCA, dealing with insurance, dealing with anything to do with putting through applications.
You make some really good points, Nicole. There are pros and cons of both. There is, to me, one is not necessarily clearer than the other one. So what we've done, you just talked about the network there. So previously, we have promoted that direct authorization approach. That to me has been the one that if you trust yourself. I've got three questions we ask people. Do you trust yourself? Do you trust the client? Does the client trust you? If you can answer yes to those three questions, you've got nothing to be fearful of direct authorization. You should be absolutely fine. If there's any doubt, then you become an appointed representative of somebody else. So there are pros and cons in terms of both. What we've done recently, you mentioned the network there. You mentioned Mortgage Introducer. That's actually an industry publication. And you probably read an article in Mortgage Introducer.
I did. Sorry.
So our network. So we've got. It's very confusing, our industry, Nicole. It's not your fault. It's our fault. Our communication is poor. We have a network now because, going back to what I said earlier on about always having to move on, move forward, pivot if you have to. We're happy to do a U-turn. We own all our U-turns. If we're missing a trick, we've gone down, you know, a wrong way, we'll just turn around and come back. We've got no problem doing that. You have to do that in business. So we have a big direct authorization proposition with our brands that we mentioned earlier on. What we realized as well is it's twofold. One, the regulator is falling to pieces from an administration point of view. Okay. So previously, it might take 3 months to get a firm authorized in the good old days. You're now looking at 9 to 12 months. That's a long leading time to put yourself in a position of being able to trade. And a lot can go wrong in those 9 and 12 months. So because of that, we've had to rethink a little bit about what we do. If we went down the network route and we created that umbrella company that we talked about earlier on and we plugged ARs into that, we can do that within 6 weeks. An individual can get authorized within 6 weeks. So we've suddenly saved ourselves 10 months of heartache. And improve the process significantly for the broker. Because all the broker really wants to do is continue to trade. That's all they ever want to do. They don't want to be unable to trade. And some contracts in our industry can be very, very harsh and very unfair to the broker. We see lots of examples of that. And we're going to go the other way in terms of making it fair to the broker. But what it does is it causes people to, it overloads them. And then they end up actually not making a decision.
Yeah.
Remaining where they are. And that doesn't necessarily help them at all. They'll just go, oh, too much effort. And you know, that doesn't benefit them. So having our network, having also an appointed representative model, now gives us two strings to our bows. We can find the right business people that are fine to be directly authorized and we can brand them up, but also those that are quite happy to sit within a network, well, we can now accommodate that. So really what it's done from our point of view is probably given us the capacity to double in size in 12 months if we wanted to do that.
Yeah, I read of your co-founder, Scott Thorpe, is it?
Yeah.
He was saying that you want to have 124 firms under your umbrella by 2020, so it's a little bit out of date. But
that was probably pre-pandemic as well. So all our numbers have changed off the back of that. Yeah. So there's two metrics to look at that, I think, Nicole. One is what is the numerical headcount of individual brokers? That's one way that you can judge scale in our sector. I think at the moment across the Money Group, we probably have 110 brokers. There or thereabouts. The other metric is how many ARs can you recruit into your business? At the moment, we've probably got 4 or 5, but that we can probably go to 10, 15 or 20 within the next sort of 12 months. That could then double our headcount from 110 brokers up to 220 brokers in that time. So from a speed point of view, it pays dividends to have that additional network option for people.
And to remain nimble and totally. Just the ability to do that and make those changes quickly. Yeah, so just to reiterate, and just so for my understanding, you've got the direct authorization route where someone can come in who has a successful Keith's shed is growing really exponentially, but he has decided that he wants to brand and be Keith's money.
Correct.
So he then will bring his authorization under the brand of the money group.
Yeah,
sure. Correct. And then on the other side, you've got Nicole, who's operating and has decided that she doesn't want any of the headache and wants to be authorized really quickly so she can come in as an authorized rep.
Absolutely. And if you want to run yourself as, you know, Nicole Mortgages, you can do, or you can be Nicole Money. You know, we can still brand you, even though you're gone down the AR route. We still have that flexibility and that option. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And let's just look a bit at the market, because we've talked a lot about your company, and again, I think you've done a fantastic job, and it's just, it's very simple, as you say, on the tin.
Because I am.
Well, you have a simple way of putting things. Yeah. Let's look at the market and let's see if you can as simply talk about the market. We saw the, after everyone got over the initial shock of lockdown, we saw the market go crazy, and now it seems to be softening a bit. What is your view of what's happening at the moment with the supply and the demand specifically?
Really difficult to try and put a glass over that and call it something. What we don't know, because we have this debate all the time, we can't work out why we're having month after month of record numbers, because, you know, we've been around long enough to know that that can't carry on forever. We're very realistic in our business, you have to be. Whilst we'll always think positive, we'll also be very realistic. So what we don't know is what the market would be like had we not had the pandemic. This might actually be the normal market. We could still be suffering the effects of the lockdown. Don't forget, the market really only closed for about 8 to 10 weeks back in March 2020. I don't think there's enough pent-up demand that 18 months later we're still, you know, suffering an avalanche of business. That doesn't seem to be right to me. I think a lot of that was caused by the stamp duty holiday that was brought in way too early, in my opinion. What Rishi and Boris didn't see was what we saw at the coalface, which was the demand was there the moment lockdown ended first time around back in May and June of 2019. We could see that. So we knew that actually the market was going to fire up very, very quickly. To then pour, you know, petrol, not that you'd waste petrol there, but if you didn't.
There is none. There's still none where I am.
No, if you were going to throw some much needed petrol onto the bonfire, that was the wrong time to do it. Because suddenly, you know, when the market will flatten and plateau, and you're right, I think that's probably happening now at the moment. That would have been good to hold in reserve and maybe use in Q1 of next year when it might have some real value. Where's the market at the moment? Difficult to say. I think the problem you've got is that it's such an emotive subject, property. Mm-hmm. People can be very, very influenced by the media. And I don't know about you, Nicole, but it's getting very hard work to follow the news at the moment. Awful lot of negativity around. I don't know, their job is to spin news to be interesting, and that generally is bad news. That's much more interesting than good news. But I think at the moment, with the talk about inflation, supply chain issues, we just talked about petrol then, you know, significant house prices, the cost of living is increasing. It's a difficult time, I think, for the country going forward. That will inevitably have to impact somewhere on the line in terms of property. How, I'm not entirely too sure. We've got ourselves in a bit of a mess because affordability is not an issue in the industry anymore for borrowers. You can borrow, you know, you can fix for 5 years at under 1%. Now, that's crazy when in 2008, the five-year money was probably 5%. You know, and we've had increases in salary in the meantime. House prices increased as well. And we've got borrowing costs at an all-time low. Borrowers would borrow vast amounts more money tomorrow if the rules allowed them to do it. It's not the cost of servicing it that's the issue. It's probably the regulation that stops them doing it. Now, arguably, that's a good thing. It stops people going, you know, it stops us having another credit crunch too, potentially, where we've lent aggressively, or the market is much more mature than it was in 2007.
If we think about the mortgage market, it's quite a new market, really, especially on the buy-to-let side. It hasn't been around that long.
No, people forget this. It's a very, very young industry, very, very young. I would arguably say it's probably just over 20 years old, which if you compare that to accountancy, surveying, you know, lawyers, you know, hundreds of years around, it's still very, very young. So mortgage lending probably, I remember the old days where you didn't get paid to do mortgages. That's again, how old I am. So it wasn't until around about 1998, 2000, we kind of had a big bang in the industry whereby the rules changed, banks found a different way to raise money, they could create it effectively on the balance sheet with the stroke of a keyboard. And what that led to was a dash for market share. So if you want to look for all the problems that we had in 2007, it actually started back in 2000 when it became, trying to get double-digit market growth was really what all the lenders were about. That's all they were interested in. And they were throwing money at that left, right and centre. And then when it wasn't so much about cost, it was about criteria. So then they start to soften criteria to encourage more borrowing, to encourage more lending, which is why you ended up in the summer of 2007 with self-cert mortgages, interest-only mortgages, and 125% loan-to-value mortgages. There was no surprise to anybody that that was going to go pop. So it's still young. So yes, it is definitely a young industry. It's a much better industry now than it was 10 or 15 years ago. The banks are better capitalized, better regulated. I'd argue that they had a very good pandemic. If you think back to that vampire squid banking sector in 2007, and you can compare it to today, don't forget that something like, I don't know the actual numbers, but maybe 9 million people rang their lender last March and asked for a payment holiday. You know, that's not significant. Some lenders were taking 70,000 calls over a 3-day period. They were all granted a payment holiday. That's effectively, you know, a bank saying, yeah, don't pay us for 3 months. Everything's fine. That's a tough gig for a bank. You throw on top of that the CBILS loans that they had to fund, the bounce back loans, and they stayed open, you know, to do some lending. I think this time around, the banks actually proved themselves culturally to be a completely different beast to where they were in 06 and 07.
Yeah, that's a good point that you make, because it shows a certain maturity and stability that wasn't there in the first crisis.
Yeah.
Every now and then we see news about these self-cert mortgages popping back up again, and 100% mortgages, or at least 98% mortgages. Are they coming again?
Self-cert, no. We're not going to go down that road again. And thankfully, I remember days when you know, people with pretty basic jobs could fill in the application form and put down whatever income they wanted to. The attitude of the lenders was, that's fine by us if your client's prepared to sign the declaration. That was the culture at the time. Totally wrong. That culture's not there now. If it ever returns, I'd probably have to think my own time in the industry is at an end, because that's definitely not the right direction we need to go down. High loan to value lending is still there. So 95% is probably the higher loan to value that you will get. Quite difficult to achieve, because the lenders will market the fact that they're in the market to lend 95%, but behind the scenes, they will tweak their algorithms so tightly that only the queen will qualify for borrowing. So it's more of a headline than a bottom line, I would suggest. But there are a couple of other companies out there at the moment that are bringing in some innovation, which is quite interesting to see, whereby you might borrow X from Halifax as a mainstream lender, and they'll actually fund you the difference. So actually, in a roundabout way, 100% mortgages are possible. Barclays have a springboard mortgage, whereby you can use equity or savings in a family member. So they are there, but not in the same guise that we had in 07, whereby it was a pure 100% lending. I personally I've been having some very in-depth conversations with a client who wanted to go down that particular route, especially in the current climate.
I guess it allows people to use the bank of mum and dad when they're buying a home, which they're... Sorry, it's my dog.
It's embarrassing.
Not mine. I guess it allows the bank of mum and dad to fund mortgages, which seems to be a vast majority of young people's mortgages now.
Bank of mum and dad are probably the biggest, one of the biggest lenders in the UK, without a shadow of a doubt. It's very, very rare for us to see a first-time buyer, I'm trying to think if I've seen one recently, that is coming to the market without some family money of some description. They're definitely underpinning the first-time buyer market without a shadow of a doubt. So that transfer of wealth from parents to children is happening much earlier on now than rather than waiting to the back end. They're essential. They're essential part of the market.
Yeah, no, exactly. I've got a statistic, actually, that I just can't recall it, the number of first-time buyers that are bank of mum and dad, and it's interesting. And it is going to bring that whole baby boomer trickle down of wealth forward so many more years. And it's going to be interesting, actually, just as an aside, how that will then impact on treasury receipts for inheritance tax later on.
Well, this is where we sometimes make mistakes, I think. The planning, we never think about the unintended consequences of what we do until it's too late. And then we all go, maybe we shouldn't have done that, or there was a better way to do it. Mm-hmm. We tend to lurch from one idea to another one, live for today, kick the tin down the road as far as possible, and hopefully the problems will arrive on somebody else's watch. That tends to feel what this country's done for about 20 years now. There's no real long-term planning going on that I could see. And I think that's probably the biggest disappointment I've got at the moment, is that we're not really thinking 10, 20, 30 years down the road.
Yeah, I would agree with you, especially when it comes to those sorts of things. Just to now look at you personally, I can hear a northern lilt in your accent.
I'll try to beat it out of myself. I'm from Lancashire originally, a seaside town called Morecambe, which very, very, very few people bother going to now. But I do have fond memories of it because, you know, I grew up in the 80s. It was a great time. It seemed like the weather was warm all the time. Everyone was in a good mood. The music was a lot better. And then what happened is we started to go on cheap holidays to Spain. in the late 80s, and that kind of killed my hometown because they just couldn't compete with 2 weeks of blistering sunshine and pina coladas when all you've got is an amusement arcade and Happy Mount Park, you know. So it was a shame, really, but that's progress. That, you know, that happens. I mean, Brighton's kind of probably bucked the trend a little bit. That's probably not a fair example, but a lot of the old seaside towns, of which I am a product of one, do struggle nowadays because maybe slightly different in lockdown because we haven't been able to go to Spain. So, but I think some of these seaside towns need a complete reinvention, you know, yeah, to bring back some of the glory days. So that's where I'm from originally. I didn't have a strong accent. I've never sounded like I've come from Coronation Street, thank God. Some of my family members do sound like that, which is why I avoid them at all costs. But to me, I've been down south since I left home at 19. You know, I did the classic Dick Whittington, you know, packed my bag, got on a coach. Hopefully the roads were paved with gold and came down to London. So it's probably softened over the years a little bit. The more I drink, the more northern I sound like.
Yeah, it's just words here and there. London. And yes, probably like my Australian accent, since it was very much the same story, leaving and at 21 and coming over here.
But isn't that great that we can do that, though, Nicole?
It is. It's great. And for me, I'm very thankful that this country allowed me to come in and stay. Yeah. And while I'm an economic migrant, I'm really proud to also be British. And I'm a proud British. I've got my passport here somewhere. I'm a proud British passport holder.
Did you get a red one?
No, this is my old one. It's expired now. But yeah, I haven't got the blue one yet. Not until a couple of years. And I hear you frequent the red light districts.
Right. For some immediate context, from some immediate context on that, Nicole.
Yes, please.
This goes back to just what we're talking about there. You know, when you come from quite an introvert place, and my hometown is very, very introvert, I guarantee if I went back there, everyone that I went to primary school probably still lives there. That's what I mean by introvert. Their idea of progress is probably getting a bus into the big town next door. To me, that was never good enough. I really wanted to see a different side to life. And that's what drew me down to London. And I think if you're going to go anywhere from a big city point of view, you get right into the heart of that. I don't think there's no point sitting in the suburbs, no point, you know, commuting an hour in. I think you get right into the centre of it. So when I moved to London, it took me a while to get there, but I made it about 10, 15 years ago. I moved into Soho. Just to say that, you know, when people say, oh, I live in town, where do you live? You know, Edmonton, sorry, that's not town. To me, town is right, you know, on top of Piccadilly Circus. That's to me the epicentre of everything. So I lived there for about a year and a half. Really fantastic to be able to just get up and, you know, you're in the middle of everything. You're 2 minutes from Piccadilly Circus. They're a minute from Leicester Square. It was a 5 minute walk to the office, which was in Holborn or so at the time. So I just love, I'm glad I've got that on my CV in terms of, you know, I'll say to my boy when he gets older that two things you should always do is one, live in the middle of a city, and two, try and live abroad for a while. That will make you a very, very grounded, cosmopolitan individual. And just to bookend that story, I also lived in the red light district in Amsterdam. just because, again, I wanted to live abroad for a while, you know. And going back to 2006, 2007. So, you know, you could do that. I could fly in from Amsterdam, return for less than £30, you know. And it was
Amsterdam.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an hour flight. So I was right in the middle of the red light district there. And it's just great to live in another city and see completely different things than the stuff that, especially when you come from Morecambe, you thought you'd never see. I saw it all.
That is not for this podcast, but I'm really intrigued and I'll meet you down the pub.
We'll do an after hours one, Nicole, on that.
Exactly. Censored.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I lived in Clerkenwell, which is not really central, but people would say...
You can walk. I lived in Islington as well, so, you know, you can walk in from there. It's half an hour into town, which is much more interesting than jumping on the tube and smelling someone's armpit. So, you know, that zone one and two, you're in the action there, I would suggest.
And being in the action, I'm sure, has given you lots of material for your stand-up comedic career.
That was almost as brief as my IFA career, I'll be honest with you, Nicole. Yes, that was an interesting period of my life. But tell you what, some really good analogies for business I got from that. Okay, I did it for a year or two, just, you know, whilst doing the day job, obviously. I was never going to make a career out of it. But when you walk out on something like the Comedy Store stage, have you ever been to the Comedy Store in Leicester Square? Okay, so it's a spiritual home for comedy. Goes back 25, 30 years. I spent lots of time watching people down there. So to get the opportunity to stand on that stage and deliver what turned out to be less than a minute's worth of material before I got gonged off, the failure doesn't bother me. The success was that no one from Morecambe who got on the coach in 1988 managed to stand on the stage at the Comedy Store and give it a go. There were a few more successful gigs than that, I'll hasten to add, but that was the one for me that made it all worthwhile. And from a business point of view, you can't be scared to go into a meeting when you stood in front of 400 drunk tourists on a bank holiday Monday who are quite happy to throw vegetables at you because you're so bad. So when you then have a meeting with someone who might be a CEO of a business, you're not scared of anything. That's what I got from that. It gave me a complete different level of confidence that I would have had if I had not done it.
And also, I was speaking about creativity and the influence on business, or maybe the other way around. You used the recent lockdown to write a book.
Absolutely.
What is your book? What did you write about?
Do you remember we messaged each other during lockdown?
We did, yeah.
You tried to get a group together. I don't think that that happened for one reason or another.
It didn't, no.
No. Well, the analogy I do, that writing is a creative process, as is business. But the two biggest killers of both of those things are procrastination and self-doubt. And that was the analogy I was looking for there, is that, yes, we all procrastinate at work. If I can put something off or delegate it, I will do. And we all get that imposter syndrome that you think someone at some point is going to tap you on the shoulder and go, you've had a good run in business now, you know, we've seen through you. There's not a lot there. The same thing happened in lockdown. I thought, well, God, you know, we didn't know how long it was going to last. I had a lot of time on my hands. So I sat down and started to write a book. And 105,000 words later, I'm just about knocking it into shape to hopefully send it out to someone to get some rejection, because that's a numbers game in the same way that comedy is, or the same way that business is. It's got to start somewhere. But to me, that's a really important personal development from my point of view, because you always think, I wonder if I, you know, am I talented? Can I do anything other than my day job? Until you sit down and try it, you'll never know. And I think we, as humans, we're quite guilty of just getting on that treadmill and plodding along and then falling off after 3 score years and 10 and never knowing. So we are, you know, so part of the comedy stuff was to see, could I do that? Could I have made that a career if the sliding doors had been slightly different? So I now know the answer to that. And now I'm doing the same from a writing point of view. You know, I mean, you talk about tweets. 105, I worked out last night, actually, 105,000 words is something, it's only like 2,500 tweets, which sounds like a lot, but not to me. I can do that in 2 days. So I started to think, well, if I can do all those tweets, surely I can write a book. Anyway, I have. Whether it's any good, it's not for me to say.
Is it a novel then? It sounds like it's a novel rather than a business book.
It is a novel, yeah. It is a novel. Absolutely, it's a novel. The problem with that is that you can become so close to it that you convince yourself you've actually done something worthwhile. To me, it feels like it's a story. It's got a beginning and a middle and an end, which is always a good start. I think it's got some strong characters within it. I think it's plausible and I think it's authentic. So I've convinced myself it's good. The challenge now will be trying to find out if anyone agrees with me. So I'll keep you posted on that.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to a review copy, Martin, so I can review it. And if it's half as good as your tweets, then it will be a great book. I am looking forward to it. Yeah, indeed. Yeah, man, we could sit down and talk for hours, but our time's probably up now. And it was really good just to hear about. And it was good to spend some time seeing exactly what you're doing and how big this London money can grow. And so I'm going to enjoy watching from the sidelines.
Thank you, Nicole. It's nice to do this. You know, the problem with social media is that we judge people very, very quickly on a few words that they put out there, and it's dangerous. And I'm sure you've probably been, you've seen the other side of that as much as I have. And people are very quick to judge, and people are very quick to formulate an idea about you. And the reality actually often is very, very different. I've made mistakes. I've been very quick to prejudge people, not yourself, clearly, but other people. And actually, they've enlightened me and educated me that actually I'm the problem, not the solution in terms of that. So it's been nice to be able to talk to you, Nicole.
Yeah, you too. Thank you very much, Martin. And do follow Martin. He is a prolific and intelligent tweeter. He's one of only two tweeters that I follow, actually. That I regularly follow.
He's the other one.
Henry Pryor.
Oh, Henry. Yeah, he's all right.
Yeah, he's awesome.
He won't follow me back, so don't follow him. That's how pathetic I am.
Yeah, he unfollowed me too. And then when I sent him a cry face, he said that it's part of his new system. Strategy. But he said he still sees my tweets.
Good.
Henry, I'm on to you. But no, do follow Martin at London Money FS. And follow on with the story. It's a great one. So thanks again, Martin. And thank you all for listening. See you on Twitter.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please support us with a like, comment, subscribe, and share. And you can always join the conversation live across my YouTube, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages at 1 p.m. every Thursday. See you there soon.